It is 6 o'clock. I'm going to call the June 16th meeting of the Claremont County Public Library Board of Trustees to order. May I have roll call, please?
Ms. Doss?
I am here.
Mr. Ramos?
Here.
Ms. Wade?
She's here.
Ms. Casica?
Here.
Mr. Humphrey?
Here.
Thank you.
All right, everybody.
Ms. Fox? Ms. Schluter?
Thank you.
All right, let's stand for the pledge. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Next item on the agenda is a motion, please, to approve the May 19th, 2025 minutes as mailed. Do I have a motion?
I'll make that motion if there are no corrections.
All right, Mr. Humphrey makes a motion. Mr. Ramos seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Next on the agenda is public participation. I don't believe we have any. Is that correct? No public participation. All right. Next up, Mr. Ramos, BOT brief, please.
So we talked about the board being a body that can sue or be sued. The Claremont County prosecutor by statute is our legal counsel, but there is a procedure whereby if the board felt it was in our best interest or if the prosecutor had a conflict where we can retain what's referred to in the statute as independent legal counsel. Now, there's a particular procedure to do that, but at least we have that opportunity. It can be obtained, as I indicated, if the board thinks it's in our best interest, or if the prosecutor, for example, has a conflict of interest. The example that I read about was where there was a disagreement with regard to the tax distribution of funds to the board. The prosecutor is on the budget committee. He's on the budget committee, so there's an obvious conflict there. So that's just an example, and just so we are aware that we have that as an option.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? All right. Next item on the agenda is our Get to Know the Library series, and it looks like we are going to talk about Miami Township. May I just say, don't go, Elise. Please.
Just checking.
goes forward, right?
Yeah, okay.
They say these from year to year.
All right, are we all ready? All right. So I'm Elise Wrench. I'm the branch manager at the Miami Township Library, and I've been the branch manager here since August 2024. Laurie Henry did initially present the Miami Township branch in March of 2024, but we've had a few changes since then, including me. So we're going to just do a little update today. I'm going to very briefly talk about the history and the branch, show you some pictures of the location, and describe some of the things we do in support of the Claremont County Public Library strategic plan. So the Miami Township branch remains one of the busiest branches in the system. Last year, we did account for about 23% of CCPL's total circulation, with over 300,000 items circulating. Nearly 250,000 of those items were books. Almost 7,000 items were checked out from our library lockers, and we welcomed about 92,000 visitors through the door, showing just how vital this space is to the community. All right, here's my very brief branch history. There have been four locations of the Milford Miami Township Library during the past 66 years. The library was obviously first established at 19 Water Street as a private library in the early 1900s. In 1959, the Miami Township Library became the first branch of the Claremont County Public Library System. Very exciting. When more space was needed in 1983, the library found a location at the former Ohio Valley Egg Co-op property. And then in 1996, it became pretty clear that that branch was too small and it had some structural damage, so the library moved to the old Rock Bottom Grocery Surplus building on State Route 131 in 1997, and that building on 131 now serves as the Milford School District Central Office. The library outgrew that space, and we moved into our brand new space in this building on St. Patrick's Day in 2018. The new building includes both the library, obviously, and then the administrative offices and support departments, and the library itself gained about 10,000 square feet during the move. So with the additional space and the upgraded facilities, we were able to enhance our service model to better meet the needs of our growing community. Now, in order to provide excellent service for our guests, we primarily staff two staff members at the front desk. We utilize the back service desk for more time-intensive services like ordering 3D prints and scanning documents to Jobs and Family Services. We also use that back desk and standing service point for guest service overflow, especially during really busy times like right now during summer reading or on story time days. The library serves as a community space for both studying and working. We just finished our busiest time of the year to see high school students visit the library. We had lots of guests studying collaboratively for AP tests this spring. The study rooms are available for group work and collaboration. You can write on the walls with dry erase markers or connect your laptop to the big screen. And all the meeting and study rooms can be reserved from our website, obviously through Vega. We offered a quiet study room for those who need a silent work environment. It is not reservable, but we have a lot of guests who like to go in there for a little bit of peace and quiet. And then throughout the branch, tables are accessible for individual or informal study or work. And it's not unusual to find all of our open tables being used by guests studying and working. I was actually surprised when I got here by how many people we have just coming in and spending their whole day with us. Picture here is our community puzzle table. It's a favorite spot for guests to work together. And also shown is our children's area, which is a vibrant space, always buzzing with activities and toys and learning games. Our makerspace is equipped with a wide range of creative tools, including computers loaded with Adobe Creative Cloud software like Photoshop, a VHS to DVD converter, a button maker, a die cut machine, and a silhouette machine. Among these, the button maker and die cut machine are by far the most popular with our visitors. We also find our guests using our makerspace as a makeshift study room. They go in, they all get logged on to the computers together, and then they work in there. Obviously, you all are familiar with meeting rooms A and B. They're versatile workspace that we host a variety of programs in, and workshops, community gatherings throughout the week and on the weekends. On nicer days, guests can also enjoy our outdoor patio. as a peaceful spot to unwind and work in the fresh air. Also pictured is our cozy fireplace area, complete with comfortable seating, perfect for reading, relaxing, and enjoying quiet conversation. So speaking of the Miami Township staff, we are currently staffed at 14. There are two librarians, including me, the manager, and three service specialists, and 9 library assistant specialists. As I said in the beginning, I'm Elise French, I'm the branch manager. I joined CCPL in March of 2020 as the Union Township branch manager. I moved over here to Miami Township in August of 2024. I am the current chair of the Summer Reading Committee. I'm also a reference trainer, a member of the Staff Recognition Committee, through which I run our system secret PAL program every year. I'm the co-chair of the Library Con Steering Committee this year and a member of the Staff Training Committee. And I also chair our Niche Academy Training Committee, which is really just me and one other person uploading things on our Niche Academy, but it sounds fancier. Outside the system, I am the Books by the Banks volunteer coordinator for the city of Cincinnati, or for the area of Cincinnati, and I'm the SWAN Summer Reading Conference Planning Committee member, and I present at the SWAN Summer Reading Planning Conference. Andy Hissett is our adult services librarian and has been here for about 10 years. Prior to that, he worked 15 years in the Cincinnati-Hamilton County Public Library. At CCPL, he serves on the Database Preview Committee and is currently a database trainer. So he trains new staff on all of our databases and their uses. He's also the president of the SWANS Adult Library Programming Community Group. Kelly Clark has been in CCPL since 1995. She's worked at a number of branches, including MT and Amelia, and was the original reference floater. She serves on the Senior Connections Task Force. Kevin started in August of 2022 as a youth services specialist at MT, and he's been here ever since. He currently leads the Customer Service Committee and is a teller for the Dreamweaver Story Troop.
2002.
What did I say?
2022.
Oh, no, he's been here a lot longer than that. Like 23 years.
Because we started the same year. So.
Thank you. And then Erin Smith will celebrate 28 years of service in July. And she began her journey as a youth services specialist at the Amelia branch with brief assignments at Owensville and Bethel before settling in at Miami Township in 2000. And she's currently a member of the School Readiness Committee. So all of our service team has been here more than 10 years. We have 4 full-time LAS positions. Allison Insgo has worked in libraries since 2021, but she just joined us here at Miami Township in February of 25. Carson is a library assistant specialist and has worked for the system for 8.5 years. She worked as a lead LA, full-time in LAS. And before she worked for us, she was actually a volunteer for the system. Melissa Cavell has worked in the Miami Township branch for a little over 5 years. She's a 3D printing enthusiast and serves on our 3D printing committee. She also does the majority of the actual printing in our branch, although all staff can do it. And Misty Warren began her library career as a part-time employee at Goshen in August of 2012. Later that fall, she moved to a full-time position at Miami Township, and she currently represents the branch on the safety committee. So we have 7 part-time LAS positions. We currently have 2 staff members in the process of being hired, most likely looking to have them start in July. Hope started working as a part-time library assistant specialist in February of 24, and she works on the monthly marketing chat team. Christina started working at the branch in July of 2024, and she serves with me on the summer reading committee as kind of my backup staff person. Previously, she worked in libraries in San Antonio, Texas, and Richmond, Indiana. Kaylee Rains just completed her master's degree in English from Wright State University this May, and she began working at Miami Township in January of this year. She actually accepted a promotion as the intergenerational service specialist at Owensville, and while she was here with us today, today is actually her first day of her new position as well. And then Michaela Beckley and Olive Wiggins joined Miami Township on June 2nd, just in time to learn about summer reading. So we are continuing to grow our outreach efforts and strengthen connections throughout the community. I had the opportunity to speak at the City of Milford government meeting last December to share our work and build awareness around library services. I was also a guest on MTTV, Milford's local news show, highlighting summer reading, library lockers, and library con. We've built a strong relationship with local organizations, and so we regularly attend events like Art Affair, National Night Out, and the Frontiers Day Parade to stay engaged and visible. In May of this year, we hosted the Claremont County Chamber of Commerce Summer Tailgate event, which was a great opportunity to connect with local businesses and residents. Those efforts reflect our ongoing commitment to access and community engagement across the region. The branch typically averages around 20 book a librarian appointments each month. Most of those are unscheduled, but our staff is increasingly encouraging guests with time-intensive needs to schedule appointments in advance. In addition, we proctor a variety of tests for guests throughout the year, ranging from GIA gemology evaluations to real estate exams. Last fall, Miami Township used book sale funds to purchase two sets of Ozobots, which are like tiny robots that teach kids how to code. So Kevin Isaac's been actively programming with the Ozobots and is currently leading a four-month-long Ozobot series leading into the STEM education. We also offer 3D printing classes for children, teens, and adults. Kelly Clark is the queen of our adult craft programs here at Miami Township. She has led events like Easy Evening Sky Painting and creating vision boards. Erin Smith launched an Art in the Afternoon series for this summer to complement the summer reading theme, which is Color Our World. We focus on creating high-impact displays to boost circulation. Hope Stanger, in particular, emphasizes engaging nonfiction STEAM displays for youth. You can see one at the front of the branch right now. It's her cabbage color experiments. You can see that she did the experiment, and she's also put out sheets that guests can take home and do the experiment at home. So our wide variety of adult programs, we want to see a diverse range of ages attending the event. We strive to balance our programming to reflect both the wants and needs of the community. We have a regular and well-attended offering with our senior cafe. Some of those gatherings are very relaxed and social, featuring games, puzzles, and conversations, and others are more structured with presentations on topics like downloading and using Libby and the library app. We offer well-attended story times for babies and toddlers and children of all ages. In May, during our story time break, we partnered with Dance Etc. to present a music and movement program. During the early part of 2025, we hosted some senior-focused presentations, including one from the Linder Center of Hope on mental wellness and healthy living. And we had a visit from two of the representatives of OSHIP, which is the Ohio Senior Health Insurance Information Program, who shared valuable insights on Medicare services and regulations. Our youth services team is actively working to build stronger connections with Milford area schools. We obviously have an excellent ongoing partnership with Elizabeth Ann Seton and Mulberry Elementary since they're next door, and we do get to see their kids in the branch. They walk over to visit us. In the 2024-2025 school year, we issued about 125 Free For Me cards. And I met with the Milford District Librarian last September and followed up in the spring with her in regards to summer reading. As a result, we connected with four Milford schools that we don't normally see, and we were able to expand our outreach this fall with literacy nights and family events. Our weekly story time actually averages between 25 to 40 guests in each session. Once a month, we do offer story time specifically for babies. And you can see some of our pictures of our guests doing activities above, creating fairy houses and flying kites. Some of our youth and teen programs for 2024-2025 included Craftapalooza, Ozobot programs, 3D printing for teens that was Star Wars-based, and Grandparents' Day Tea Party. So from fun and educational story times for little ones to system-wide reading programs that keep kids and teens engaged all year round, we're all about building a love of reading for an early age. We're also expanding our community outreach and engagement and connecting with families through events and partnerships across the area, especially at the Miami Township Civic Center, where we host a free adult program every month. In 2024, like I said, the Miami Township branch did check out almost 7,000 books and other materials via our library lockers, so they do remain very popular at this location. They're great for guests who find it inconvenient to come to the branch during our normal open hours. We also have a very successful 3D printer setup at Miami Township, and all of our guests are regular users. The challenge we really face here is meeting the needs of our busy guests. With packed schedules, it's not always easy for them to attend programs or get to the library during open hours to browse the shelves. We often have programs with full registrations and waiting lists, but some of our guests aren't able to attend, and then we aren't able to move guests off the waiting list. So our branch programming staff has been actively working on getting people in the door for our programs. We've been making reminder calls and opening up to increase our attendance and adding more registration spots. So that is all I have for you from the Miami Township branch today. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, thank you all so much.
Thank you. I should probably share that Lisa's only with us till the end of June. She is moving on to Georgia,
The study rooms are always busy.
The blue is more calming. It just seemed to work better. But I passed my exam. It was fantastic. So, yeah. Good stuff.
If you're wondering about the future of the branch management, Emily Wickman is transferring from Bethel, Williamsburg, to Miami Township starting June 30th, I believe. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Elise. So I think next, do I have volume back on the microphone?
Testing.
There it is. All right. Next on the agenda is fiscal officer's report.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take it away.
We have our May financial report as sent to you, the bank reconciliation, followed by the check register with our month-to-date and year-to-date bank and fund reports, end-of-month balancing report, our PLF fund report. We should be getting the new estimates in July for that. Our resolutions, the gift and the obsolete inventory resolution. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a minute. Our supplemental information, and then our revenue and expense sheet, which you'll notice that some additions have been made, comparing changes from the previous year. And then we have, Debbie is going to speak about our fiscal office report.
So our 2024 audit is still ongoing, but all three of our suggestions for improvement items on the 2023 audit have been addressed and are corrected for 2025. I attended three webinars pertaining to investments, and I earned an additional 3 CPIM credits. Melanie and I both received additional clarification and training on the estimated revenue entries made yearly and how they relate to the special funds. Melanie and I met to go over my quarterly performance review and progression towards my yearly goals. And we are still documenting all of our fiscal procedures. We're making very good headway on all of that. It seems like it's going to be never-ending, but we are doing pretty good.
But don't dare print them out because they change all the time.
That's right. Exactly. Melanie attended the admin team meetings, and both Melanie and I attended the managers and the support department meetings.
Do we have a sense of how long it takes the state to approve the 2023 audit?
I do not. They sent me the invoice for that, so I'm assuming we must be getting close.
Is that a question that we can put to the auditors to ask them? You know, like, what's the expected turnaround time? Because I'm sure they have a required turnaround time for that. And that maybe might be helpful for you guys to project or forecast when you'll have...
I will get with them and find out.
Okay, thank you. And I like you giving the report too. So I like the tag teaming. It's good. It's good. Good experience. Any questions on our fiscal officer report?
What were the three suggestions for improvement?
The one was the stale and outdated checks. I hadn't done that because I wasn't really sure about that, but we have since done that.
Cell phone?
The cell phone stipend, they wanted it announced in the board minutes, which we took care of last month. Mm-hmm. The other one was the revenue, the estimated revenue as reported to the county for our estimated, I'm not exactly sure how to explain it. It's so many pieces to it, but what it boiled down to was the amount of money that we set aside every year to transfer into those special funds for our grants, at the beginning of the year when we do our appropriations, those we were not recording as estimated revenue for the year. But the one that we did in March or April, I was recording as estimated revenue. And it was the way that I was following what had been done previously. That was done. The first one was done with the original appropriations, and that's why I didn't catch that as a different entry. So now we have gone forward and in 2025 corrected that, so it won't be like that again. So we know that 2024 is probably going to follow suit with all three of those things because they weren't corrected. We did the audits at the same time, so they couldn't have been corrected. And I said, well, no, if I did that in 2023, I'm sure I did that in 2024. And he just kind of went, yeah. So I'm expecting to see that.
So it was basically, all three of them were basically procedural issues as opposed to any substantive issues.
No, they were just suggestions for how to record them differently.
Okay.
And they weren't even included on the formal audit report?
No, just suggestions.
So not even written up.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
I was pleased.
They did a great job. They really did.
Yeah.
I'm still working on that last one with the revenue. I have a call in to the county. I want to make sure that I've got that lined up with them correct. But I made the entry, so that's where we said that has been corrected. I went ahead and made the entry. My argument was it's estimated revenue. What do you care? But they do care. So
it's checking a box.
Right. They
checking
wanted to make sure that you guys, and he specifically said, well, how does your board know how much money you have to spend? And I said, because they approved the budget.
Because we're in the budget.
Right. that was not clearly enough, but he wasn't really upset about it. It was, like I said, a suggestion. He just wanted to make sure that I was providing all the information to you, and it was easy for you to find. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Thank you. So we're still waiting. They have to file the 2023 and get it approved by the state auditor before they can file the 2024. So they're still doing a little bit on the 2024. It's not as heavy as it was, and they're wrapping that up. Thank you.
Any other questions for the fiscal office? All right, time for some motions. May I have a motion to approve the April 2025 financial reports?
So moved.
All right, Ms. Waite makes a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Mr. Humphrey seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Next one is a motion to approve the April 2025 bills paid. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Mr. Ramos makes a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Ms. Waite seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion passes.
And the third one is a motion to approve the April 2025 bill paid for Anthem alone. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Ms. Waite makes a motion. Mr. Humphrey seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes, and let the record state that I abstain. All right, next item on the agenda is our director's report, which also includes a department presentation.
That is correct.
For human resources.
A couple of things I passed out is a state budget, kind of an OLC digest. So that is an update from a recent email from them, and also we had a webinar today updating us as to the status of various things going on with the legislature, and also the July-August Library Insider. So there's a lot going on, a lot to keep track of, a lot to try and understand. It's not very easy, and I can say what was shared today was that all publicly funded entities are really feeling the pressure from this budget cycle, and it's been a difficult one from what I understand. You know, a lot of information was given about the House and its budget process with that. So recently, the Senate passed their version of the budget. It basically upheld what the House proposed, and it's spelled out a little bit more clearly in terms of the PLF and budgeting process in the document that I sent today. So it is a reduction in from what the governor had originally proposed, but I don't know that any of us are surprised that there would be a change there. It does pull the PLF out of the general revenue and makes it a line item. So there's that. What the Senate did add to this was an additional deduct from the PLF right from the top to fund State Library of Ohio, Oakland, the Ohio Public Library and Information Network, Regional Library Systems, and the Ohio Anna Library Association. The other thing I saw today was the Library for the Blind. I didn't originally see that, but yeah. So that comes right off the top. So what sounds like $490 million is reduced by that $10.3 million going to the other library support agencies. I doubt many of the legislatures or even you guys know what those agencies do. You heard me refer to the state library. Is it a public library? No. So there are some questions, you know, as to the appropriateness of that funding. And the request from OLC to reach out to the committee that is reviewing this final budget proposal to roll that back into deduction from the GRF. Another issue that is very difficult in the director's report, I'll go by bullet line, just to confirm that trustee terms would reduce from 7-year terms to 4-year terms. That affects no one in this room. Everyone here would continue with their 7-year appointment. It's just any future appointments would be 4 years. I did see in the Senate proposal how they were going to make that happen between the judiciary and the commissioners. So, or the common pleas and the commissioners. So they've spelled that out. Whether or not that all stays in the budget bill as it passes with the governor, we'll see. The real difficult one is the public library. This is the legislation. This is how it reads. A public library created under Chapter 3375 of the revised code shall place material related to sexual orientation or gender identity or expression in a portion of the public library that is not primarily open to the view of persons under the age of 18. And that's all of the description that they provide. So that makes it very difficult to interpret. What does that mean? I think we'll probably guess the letter of the law is not clear. It could mean something like, remember the old rhyme that the little girls are made of, you know, and little boys are made of puppy dog tails, the sugar and spice. That is identifying gender. According to this legislation, that book would go on the shelf that is out of view of the public, of children under the age of 18. Potty training for boys would go on that shelf. And how, what does that look like in our collection? I'm not sure, because we interfile all of our nonfiction. We always have. And this isn't just nonfiction. This is also easy books, juvenile fiction, YA material. So what is that going to look like? We don't know. So I'm hoping that there's some more guidance. I did reach out to our Senator Johnson, urging him to seek clarification. I did not get a response. I did reach out to local library directors at Brown County and Adams County, asking if they had contacted, how many times they had contacted, and if they had gotten a response, and the answer was, nobody's hearing anything. So the budget process is not complete, but there's some more updates. The Senate added a provision for County Budget Commission oversight. It was made clear today that this is already in the law in some regards. There's just a question as to whether or not it's applicable. I think the guidance has not been consistent. Some libraries have actually faced this issue and have had their revenue from their local tax levy withheld. They quoted a library system back in 2009, so we're going way, way back. But it sounds like either in the Senate version and then also in this proposed House version, which is brand new, House Bill 309, and it's repeated in House Bill 335, is it requires, instead of making it kind of ambiguous, it requires it. I'm not really sure exactly what that's going to look like, so we just need a little bit more time to figure that out. But I think one of the things that I talked with Melanie about on the second page of my document, and of course take this home and read this more closely, but this is the House Bill 309 and repeated in 335, requires a public hearing of the County Budget Commission and local subdivision entity should carry over a property tax levy dollars increase beyond 30% of the prior year's expenses for that fund. The hearing would determine the need for property tax revenue in the following year for that fund's purpose. I'm not exactly sure what that means.
We're not sure. We're going to...
We don't know if it is 30% of the local tax revenue of that year. We don't know if it means carryover of the entire fund balance. So we're investigating that. So there's a lot of things to be considered.
And also how you break out the PLF from the levy fund.
Right. Yes. I'm assuming it's the local property tax, but that's not very clear. So there is language from the Senate added in their Senate bill about the County Budget Commission. It's, according to OLC, the House bills that were introduced at the end of May are a little bit more stringent. And I included information about that. Also, additional levy passage requirements must pass by 60% versus a simple majority. We're not going out for a levy, but if we were to, if this goes into place, there would have to be 60% of the voters would have to agree to the increase. Is there anything else that I want to make sure and call out?
Flat income tax.
Oh, right. Thank you. So as you're aware that the legislature has been moving towards a flat income tax, they reduced the number of right word for that, the taxing tiers, with the move towards a flat 2.75 income tax to begin in 2 years. I think this is one of the only benefits, one of the few, I mean it's hard to say right now, but one of the few benefits of pulling the budget out as a line item is we're not necessarily affected by then, like we were a couple years ago, of the reduced income tax affecting the PLF. So with the line item, we are guaranteed that dollar amount within that budget year. So and I heard they're going to propose raising the sales tax to offset the income tax reduction. So, it's a lot. It is a lot. And they OLC is recommending a response. I updated, or I provided to you what they are urging us to do in regards to speaking with the specific individuals outlined in this document, Speaker Huffman, House Finance Chair Stewart, Speaker Pro Tem Gail Manning, Assistant Speaker Pro Tem Phil Plummer, Senate President McCauley, Senate Finance Chair Serino, Senate Pro Tem Reneke, and Senate Majority Floor Leader Gavaroni, and then Majority Whip George Lang, and then ultimately the Governor as well. So we will get to work on that. I want to be careful in that we are, it just feels different. The relationship with the legislature and the value of libraries feels different federally. It feels different locally. We're going to have, I think it's going to be a new normal, and I think we're going to have to do a good job in demonstrating our worth, right? As I identified last month, I think it's very clear that our strategic plan needs to be focused on awareness, not just locally as well as with the legislature. We do a lot. We do a lot for this community. We do a lot for these people in this community based on our goals and values and our mission. And I don't think that based on this, I think libraries are feeling very concerned. I don't want to say underappreciated. This is what I don't want to do. I don't want to make it feel like it's oppositional. I think we're looking at a paradigm shift for the time being, and we need to figure out how we're going to make this work and understand what we need to do with the budget to protect the library and our services, if that makes sense. Questions?
Has the General Assembly passed House Bill 309 and 335?
It's in committee right now.
In the House,
yes.
In the House committee. So
yes.
It hasn't even gone to the Senate?
Yes, but what they said today was they thought that the current committee there's a possibility that the Budget Conference Committee may add provisions from House Bill 309 and House Bill 335 related to the County Budget Commission to the current version of the budget.
So extrapolate those provisions that are yet to be ratified out of committee and by the General Assembly and place them in the budget?
Yes, that's my understanding. Yes, it's a possibility. I've received two emails from one of the school districts obviously affected by this and concerned about it. And I can't remember what government agency it was. A local county, you know, similar to us, receiving public tax dollars, also concerned about this. It's not just affecting libraries. It's affecting any public body that's receiving property tax dollars.
And it's a good thing we have such a healthy rainy day fund that they're looking at all of these aspects.
Well,
it is, unless
the healthy rainy day fund may be the exact reason they're looking at all of these.
And it may get us not
yes,
to get
our rainy day fund.
Not,
may
not
get
our
us
rainy
in trouble.
Fund. I'm talking about the state rainy day fund.
Okay, our
right.
Library rainy day fund may get us in trouble. We have a large rainy day fund.
Yes, and yes. That is something that, depending on where this goes, we will need to call some budget committee meetings and talk about how we're going to address this going forward. So we'll see. We'll see. All right. Any other questions about the budget information?
I think with regards to 3375, with the language for gender, it is deliberately vague.
Mm-hmm.
For interpretation, which works in the favor of any potential challenges to that, and also works in our favor as well, based on our interpretation. So, it's obviously something that's it's generating a lot of discussion, but the sky is not falling yet, so we don't, you know, let's sure. look at it. And from an interpretation perspective, I think it, as somebody who deals with that gray area all the time of, okay, well, we could do it this way or we could do it that way, which way is the way they want it, we're going to do our best effort to adhere to the law. But since we don't have specifics here, like, because we talked about this a few weeks ago, I mean, this could go down the path of, well, what about the catalog? You know, if somebody's coming in and if this material is supposed to be away from, you know, minors can come in and access the catalog, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, do you have to flag the catalog searches by age based on those minors who have cards? Like, it could go in a million different directions. So I'm curious to see how it progresses. Plan for the worst so we can be pleasantly surprised.
And just you know, anticipate us not being in compliance July 1st, because this is going to take a lot of work. You're going to have to pull materials. You have to determine what materials you're going to pull. You're going to have to shift. Where are we going to put it? Are we going to put it in the back? Are we going to put it somewhere on the public floor? Are we going to put it on the top shelf, which would be out of view? You know, as it...
Are we going to turn it to the back if the cover is the only thing? There's all kinds of...
Yes. So there's, it's going to take a long time to just, you know...
Get the plan.
And then the implementation of the plan is pulling the materials, shifting everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the important thing... From one director, as I won't use the actual words that they said, but the as you can imagine maybe what that might be, but is the materials are staying in the library. That's the important thing, is the materials are staying in the library, and we'll just have to figure out what that looks like.
So I have a question / potential suggestion for a future BOT brief. Is our library to go legally considered an extension of the library branch, where even the library to go books could be impacted by this?
No potty training for boys on the library to go bus.
No, seriously.
No, I know.
I mean, that's
not trying to make light of it.
Is that
the answer is yes?
I would think so. Yes. So it's not just our branches, but it's also the outreach programs that are impacted as well.
Oh yeah.
So.
Have they named the members of the conference committee from both the House and the Senate yet? I know that you said they adopted it on June 11th, and today's just the 16th, so...
They gave the list of individuals who we should contact, but that's...
But they didn't identify whether or not they were on the conference committee?
No.
Yeah, the ones that are doing the coming forth and bringing it for the General Assembly to vote on. Might be a good thing to see whether or not we could find that out.
Yeah, well, we get very frequent emails. Actually, one even came out, I want to say, about 5 o'clock, updating even some more information. So I will share as I get it. Moving on with the rest of the director's report, Library to Go is going well. I was kind of blown away at this one. It was a really cold, if you remember, Wednesday, May 28th, like I do. It was cold, gray, wet, and rain was expected, and we were supposed to be at 5 Points at the Splash Park to do a Library to Go, and I was like, nobody's going to show. They had over 40 people show up. I just thought that was amazing. That we partnered with Miami Township, Milford Park District, I believe, that Milford Park District, and they really promoted it, and people came out for the story time, and they really had a good time. So I think that's going really well. The shelving has come in that was purchased with the grant monies, has been installed, so the last thing to do is wrap that van, and that will happen soon. The ergonomics training was completed, and I think they were impressed with what actions that we had taken to address some of the issues that had been found to improve workflow. Managers have gone, and some managers were able to go and see additional training, and then Ed Jolly, our facility supervisor, is going to kind of continue on with that training. The current vacancies that we had, positions posted at Owensville, have been filled. I think Elise had mentioned one of the staff members that was here is transitioning over as a service specialist over there. So We will start increasing capacity for the collection building soon after the staff have some training. So that's going really well. The policy and bylaw review committee, I got information back from the prosecutor's office regarding the virtual meeting proposed policy. They had additional questions that I think we're going to end up probably calling another committee meeting.
I'll talk about that when I get the committee update.
The Bethel Roofing Consultant was out last week, and Don was there with him, and he said he was very, very thorough, so should be getting a report soon, and he will be presenting to the board, so that'll probably be occurring at the July meeting. And then the cell phone stipend, Lynn did the research. The service would cost the library an additional $45 per month per person. That is complete with a phone and the service. So I'm proposing, along with Melanie, that the stipend be reduced to $21.77 per pay period for the 8 staff members currently receiving the stipend. And if any of those staff members would prefer to have the library supply a phone, we would do that.
And I believe we have that further on the agenda as well to discuss.
Very good.
Yeah.
Excellent. Good. Yes.
Old business.
The Imagination Library is holding its own. And lastly, John Melvin informed the ClickWow committee that ClickWow is shutting down. It's done good work, but he has kind of trying to position himself kind of retiring from this committee, and he just sent an email out late Friday afternoon that they were going to shut it down. So just updating the board on that. We've been involved with that project and had lots of the tablet distribution events happening at the public library. So that's that. As far as the statistics go, the circulation, just pointing out that I'm really pretty pleased with our circulation. We're 2% of, I'm trying to think of 19. We have equaled out to where we were pre-COVID, which
Yay.
I think is really, really great. Door counts haven't recovered, but the circulation has. So I think that's really good news. And that's all I have. So now I'm ready to turn it over to Julia Berterman. If you remember, Julia is our new HR director, and she's going to tell you about one of the projects that she's been working on since she started.
Just a comment, too, on that. Those door counts,
with the switch to digital, we may never see those door counts come back up
exactly
to what they were. We are. We get two presentations in the same night. How lucky are we? All good stuff.
I will want to start the meeting. I can try and find out about that. About the starting pay, so started working on a kind of a process evaluation since I've been here. Okay, so coming in, the starting wages appear to be based primarily on the job or pay grade. So as you may or may not recognize, the library assistant specialist, the minimum set for that particular job is $14 an hour. max of 2375. So people have been brought in, primarily starting them at minimum. Sometimes there was an adjustment based upon the job market. Okay, this means that somebody who has the skill level to draw a daisy, such as that, and somebody who has the skill level to draw a daisy, such as that, were brought in at the same skill, at the same pay. Okay. So the issues with doing that are that people who, first of all, we lose talented candidates because people with a lot more to offer coming in are not offered enough. And if they do come, people with different skill levels receive the same amount of starting pay. In addition, people with similar skill levels who are brought in at different years have different pay. So this means that there are discrepancies of starting pay, and there was really no documentation of a consistent rationale. And that means that that results in valuable employees do not feel that they are valued, which means that valuable employees leave. So this involves short-term losses as managers and the branch scramble to fill the gap, and long-term losses as the library gets the reputation of not valuing talent. Okay, the solution that we're working on is a wage matrix. This introduces a structured system aligning consistency with sustainability and stewardship. So what this means is we're using a table, a structured table, to identify starting wages based upon what the job or the classification is, the years of experience or competency level, and the education or certification if that's important to the job. So again, we're calling this table a wage matrix, and it enables us to bring in consistency with how initial starting wages are assigned. The benefits of using a wage matrix are cost control, because we're using a consistent and predictable compensation practice, transparency, because we are clearly defining what differentiates starting pay, so including education and experience. It increases retention because employees feel that they are paid for their value, and also risk mitigation. So it's a defensible, data-driven approach to setting compensation. So how does it work? Oops. Okay, so for example, we have Jane Doe, who has a high school education, and she has the minimum experience. It's 3 years filling orders at Macy's. We also have another candidate, Jill Doerr, who also has a high school education, but she's got 3 years of experience doing frontline customer service work. And we have June Dothan, who has a bachelor's degree and 4 years experience working at the college library. So for Jane Doe, we're going to offer Jane Doe the minimum. She has the minimum experience and education required for the job. We'll offer Jill Doerr the minimum plus a bit extra for based upon the experience. We expect her to come in and be a bit faster than Jane in terms of getting up to speed and being able to contribute to the library's operations. And June, we're going to give her minimum plus extra for education and experience, with her education and her experience, especially the experience at the college library. We anticipate that she'll be able to really contribute very quickly and at a very high level. Okay, the return on investment that we are expecting include, first of all, we have transparency and clarity. The differences in wages make sense to employees. This means that we have fewer disgruntled employees. And you, of course, know that disgruntled employees tend to disengage, so if they're working less, they can have an impact on employee morale. So these short-term advantages lead to the long-term impact of the whole workforce is more productive. We've got lower recruitment and turnover costs because employees are feeling that they're being paid their worth, and so they're not leaving. And we have a better reputation in the community as being a library, an organization that pays for the talent. Okay, and of course, this definitely speaks to our core value of integrity, being responsible stewards of the library's assets and following ethical practices to accomplish our goals. That's it. Do you have questions?
How would the differentials be quantified?
We have a table that specifies and we identify like amounts of money to be applied for different levels of education, amounts of money to be applied for experience. And the experience we have differentiated with whether it's customer service or even library experience.
Those calculations are set up in a way that they are never going to exceed our range, right?
Oh, right, right, yes, yes, they do not exceed
the
range.
But they'll be consistent. And then are those going to be reviewed annually, or how often are those reviewed to keep pace with that minimum maximum range as well?
Well, the amounts would be increased along with the minimum maximum
range. So they're looked at the same time?
Yes,
as that? Okay.
Yes.
And then, obviously, from a transparency perspective, employees are not sharing what they, well, they, who knows what they do in private conversation, but, you know, this is transparent from a model perspective, but what other elements of this are going to be transparent to everyone? So, like, if I know coming in to the system, oh, wait, I've got a bachelor's that automatically gets me X percent differential, like, working hospital, we get a shift at for working night shift, right?
Right.
Like, similar concept is what I'm getting from this. But.
Right. And I think employees do speak to one another, and they do know when their person who is, you know, making the same has less experience than they do. They're going to identify, oh, that person has a bachelor's degree, and I have an associate's degree. So they are making a little bit more, and that makes sense.
But, like, will this be published for everyone to see what those different differentials will be for experience and for, I mean, like, is it, how transparent are we going to get with this model?
Well, it's all public information as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I understand, but I won't be setting it out and saying, hey.
Like, if the matrix can be published, is the paper.
It's an administrative tool.
Okay. Thank you for
translating.
I have two questions.
Of course.
If I may.
Yes.
One question is, how does that fit with existing employees? Mm-hmm. Won't they be honked off that this new person comes in at a higher rate than they are receiving
The existing employees also need to be addressed. We're starting with the incoming employees, but I also hope to address issues with existing employees.
One would think you have to do that all at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question is, how does this fit with our bargaining contract? How do we get this into our, or as part of our bargaining contract?
The bargaining contract needs to be involved, particularly with existing employees. So that absolutely needs to be part of going forward with the with the existing employees. Yes?
So based on your initial review of this particular program, you're basically, it sounds like, looking at revamping the entire schedule for all employees. Now, I get the part about the new employees,
yeah.
But
I want to look at the schedule, what the current employees are actually making versus what they came in at, what they're making it. So it is something that I think needs to be examined and possibly.
So it could be a total. It could be a total update of minimum bid and maximum rates, and then an adjustment to those as.
I see it more as understanding within the minimum, maximum, and middle rates, understanding where employees are. So I'm not necessarily wanting to adjust the min, max, and medium. I just want to see if an employee who has been here for 20 years and has done wonderful things is still pretty close to the minimum versus at least the medium.
Would you apply the vacancies the same way to the existing employees as you do new employees experience, education, and so on?
That is something that I'd want to look at. But not necessarily because with the current employees, you do have a better idea of what their actual, what they are actually bringing, right? So it's definitely going to be a factor. It's not going to be the only factor. With current employees, you have a lot more information.
So it
but
sounds,
yes, it's going
sounds
to be
a lot like pay for performance once they're in. And I'm not sure how our bargaining contract deals with that currently.
Understood, right. So it's a complex, it's a very complex issue.
Yes.
With our current employees. So yes, it's going to take a lot of work to identify how to do that in a way that is appropriate for all involved.
In your example, it appeared that irrespective of whether you were a high school graduate that worked for Macy's or had the field orders or whatever, so there will be a minimum rate for each one of those three categories, and then based on their education or experience, that formula, wherever it came from, will be applicable to their hourly rate.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct.
And so are those things done on a percentage, or are they done on a specific not-to-exceed amount?
What we're currently working with is an amount versus a percentage.
Percent, okay, so a flat rate.
Yes.
It will be interesting to see the analysis of the determination of education or experience or years of experience, because you could have somebody that worked at Macy's for 20 years and was, you know.
Right, and there's differentiation in terms of, is the experience relevant, right, versus or not so relevant. So somebody who worked at Amazon filling orders versus somebody who is more in customer service versus somebody who has actually worked at a library. So
I would tend to disagree with you that all experience has value. And irrespective of whether or not they're filling orders, because we fill orders here all the time, whether or not you're in the maintenance department or putting aside books or any of those kind of things, that definition of filling orders or requests versus actuality. And
I think that's what it's,
you know,
it showed, that would be the minimum anyway, with those 3 years of experience filling orders equated to a minimum start?
Additional years of filling experience, of filling orders would get additional compensation, would get additional.
I would guess that through the years that I've been involved, that the terminology of using that versus library experience. In other words, did they have any kind of library? It almost sounds like if you worked at a library, whatever experience you had, you will automatically activate in that particular category because of having library experience. But the definition of library experience is questionable too.
Yeah, and that's something that I also am trying to look at. What did that experience involve?
Got a long way to go.
Which I think ties into what Judy was saying, and that is that all experience is not just because you say experience.
Right.
But I was thinking the same thing, that you would delve into what, you know, was your experience shoveling the snow at the library, or
right.
was your experience at Macy's in the finance department, you know. So I think that I understand what you're saying. It sounds like she's going to speak to them.
I agree with Ed, though. I think that even attempting to do it, and all things are good to look at. I'm not trying to, you know, shut that down. What I'm saying is you're looking at new employees, okay, as opposed to the 100 and some we have who you're do that very same thing. Wait a second, what are they doing here? Also, that was going to be my question. How does this affect our collective bargaining agreement and whatnot? So
and our budget.
Apparently, we don't have a problem with the budget as long as we continue to be conservative.
Here we go.
So I think.
Yep, let's go, buddy.
I think.
Buckle up.
I appreciate the focus on this and thinking about this
appreciate
and how we can retain talent, right? So.
I'm sorry, couldn't
hear you.
It's not turned on yet.
Oh.
Am I turned on yet? Back now?
It would help if I turned it on. Oh my goodness. I turn it off when I sit down. I'll be all right. I appreciate the effort going into this and the attempt to look at how we can ensure we're retaining talent. That's important. I don't want to lose sight of the existing staff we have now because that's what's driving this to begin with. So I, you know, I'm in agreement with our other board members in saying that this can't be a just new people and then second phase existing employees. It really should be an all or none, first of all. I think we also need to coordinate a little bit with the personnel committee to talk about as you get more and more into this and review what your quantified numbers are, and we also need to work with legal counsel and administration on how this impacts the bargaining unit as well, because these are all, I mean, this is bigger than a bread box for sure.
As well as Bernie's comment about
as well
budget.
As the budget, yes.
Right.
As well
yeah.
as the budget.
Money.
Yes, that will be the last step, because that's the go, no-go, right?
Not necessarily. You know, that's why I asked about it.
Collaborate
or present.
Yeah. Good information. Thank you. Okay.
I want to share, too, that, you know, the perspective coming in and trying to create a consistency in this approach, I think, is something to be really appreciated, because I don't know that we've really had that in the past. And I think that does look at really what I'd like to see is the overall development of the talent pool and how we address that, the staff in general. So this is a start, because that's, and it definitely needs to, you know, extend to all staff. But this was an issue that the union brought to the library in the negotiations, was a sore spot. So trying to kind of develop more of a consistent approach to it. But yes, it does need to include existing as well.
And I think we had discussed, or we had talked as well about, you know, for those associates that take advantage of the tuition reimbursement, then what, you know, what does that do for them? Like, how does that bump them up in any type of a pay scale? Does that change anything? Or what other certifications or trainings, you know, what about that associate that's working very hard to develop themselves and continue to learn, but maybe is in the same position track, if you will, and doesn't want to go do something else within the library, but just wants to enhance their skills in the role that they have. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, curious to hear more.
I think we have a whole lot of current employees, and annually our new employees are a very small group compared to what our annual is. And so we really need to look at the annual, the current employees,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as much as the new starts.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, we try to put that, start putting that consistency in place by doing the min-max, you know, that range to begin with, which we didn't really...
No, we've always started, had a min-max.
But I thought we did some work on aligning with the...
Oh, certainly, yeah, yes.
So getting some consistency.
Right, exactly.
Updating,
right.
And,
yes. So
and,
this is
yeah.
just... This is just outlining how to address, you know, sometimes people would come in and, yes, we need to look at the whole picture, right?
Okay. All right, any other comments, questions?
Not about that, but going back, Chris, to your report, I too was enthused with the 5 points pop-up,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
How that actually developed in spite of the weather. But it kind of brings me back to one of the issues that I raised a couple of meetings ago with regard to, you know, in our evaluation with the UC research and everything, there's that gap, it seems to me, between post-high school and into the 20s. And I'm just wondering at some point in time if we could look at some means of doing a pop-up that would attract that portion of the population that we're really not getting into the
right.
library.
Right. Well, I think actually Teresa's replacement, she's impossible to replace, but her replacement, Dot Crane, started today. I think that she has got some really interesting strategic ways of utilizing communication tools that I think will help increase our
visibility,
you know, immersion into that age group. And we've done things in the past to try and attract that audience, from doing trivia at a local, I think it was a eatery, it was something in Milford.
A pub,
yeah. Didn't get enough traction. So it's not like they don't try. And I think certainly that age group with young parents are coming in. But yeah, we don't unfortunately can't spin on a dime. There's a lot of work that goes into attracting that audience, and it's going to be part of the next strategic planning cycle. But I think a lot of it is communicating with those folks and letting them know what services that we have. It's not just attending programs; it's just utilizing the library services in general. So I think I'm really interested to see what Dot can bring and. Targeting that audience.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. No, it's coming, but you can't do everything all at once.
Why not?
That's like that movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once.
If we all had a magic wand.
Yes.
If only. All right, any other questions for Chris or for Julia? Going once, going twice. All right, we're going to move on to the next item on the agenda, and that is committee reports. So, the Bylaw and Policy Review Committee, we met on June 4th. And in your packet, you have a total of, I believe, 6 different policies. I think what I'd like to do tonight, instead of going through each one and asking for a motion to approve for each one, we just do one big motion at the end, if that is agreeable to the board. Some of these have changes, some do not have changes, because there were no changes to make. So starting off with the bylaws draft, on that one,
we had included a reference under Article 3, Section 1, to virtual, all virtual meetings. And I'll talk about our virtual meeting policy here in a bit. And I believe that was really the only change. I'm just making sure because June 4th was a long time ago. Yeah, that was the only one. Any questions on that one before we look at the next? Okay. So the meeting room use policy, we had some changes with this one. We were changing all references to the library. It was lowercase. That's now uppercase. And also changing reference to patrons, changing that to guests to be consistent with our language and our other policies. We added the reference to the terms and conditions for the meeting room rules and the library usage and standards of behavior policy, just updated that title to align with that particular policy. And that was the only change to that document. Any question on those changes? Okay. The next one was the firearms, dangerous ordnance, and weapons policy. We had no suggested changes to that policy, so you don't see any edits, but I did want to put it, because we're on that review schedule, I want to include that in our policy review for the board to vote on. The investment policy statement, that we looked at, we had no suggested changes. Judy is the, you know, head of the budget committee. If you have no suggested changes as well, I think in the past, at times it floated through the budget committee to look at as well.
I did not read it in its entirety, but I saw that there was no changes to it, and whatnot, but we can certainly look at that.
It's up to you if you want to look at that in more detail or if we want to just, you know,
as the policy people looked at it and didn't see any differentiations for at this point in time, I would say it's good to go.
Okay, sounds good. The next one here is posting, displaying, exhibiting, and distribution of non-library materials policy. Again, updating the user to guest, so referring to guests throughout the document. Also changed some grammatical stuff here. So in that second paragraph, distribution of information at each branch versus at all branches. We also did a little bit more grammar down there towards the bottom of the page for permission to display material. Please see branch management versus the branch manager. And I believe that was it. So really just aligning with that guest title and grammar. And then the volunteer policy. Again, capitalizing library and referencing the library usage and standards of behavior policy by the appropriate name. We also added in an item there for volunteer candidates 18 years and over must complete a background check. We had talked about that before. If selected to become a volunteer, the library shall reimburse the cost of the background check. That was added. Those funds to reimburse for that background check come out of, I believe, our
book sale
money that we get. So,
again, is that applicable to where they would be volunteering from?
Yes. Our fiscal officer is nodding and saying yes. And then, again, just capitalizing library. So those are the only changes there. And I'll talk about the virtual meeting policy after we do a motion to approve these. So can I have a motion to approve these policies as submitted to the board?
I make that motion.
All right. Mr. Humphrey makes a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Mr. Amos seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion passes. I like doing that instead of doing each one. It's just more efficient.
The effective date is today.
Effective today, yes. Thank you. You always remind me of that, Judy, and I appreciate it because I always forget it.
Well, because I've seen where when you're looking at the document where it was like 30 days or 90 days
sure.
or whatever. So.
Sure. Because those are mostly grammatical. There's no problem with making them effective right away. There's no real policy that changed. Okay, so as far as the hybrid slash virtual meeting policy, during the committee meeting, we did look at the draft that the OLC had provided as a template, made some edits to that in discussion, and part of that discussion was not to make reference to a hybrid meeting because it's just from a technical perspective. You know, we had a presentation that it's pretty spendy. It's a digital sign to do that, to put that technology in place. So it's $50,000. I'm doing everything with in relation to a, one of our digital signs.
Less expensive for the budget. To get cardboard cutouts.
Yeah, so it's around $50,000 to do that tech for hybrid because hybrid requires so much more coordination.
Equipment.
It's not straightforward. So, you know, it's set up. Yeah, exactly. Maintenance, monitoring, all the things. So, you know, we had talked about this in previous meetings that it was my recommendation or thought that we are either all in person or we're all virtual, you know, from a quorum perspective, right? All in person or all virtual. And the all virtual would really only be used if we had to, like with pandemics or like a special meeting that we had to call, emergency meeting, something like that. The law says that before we can do a virtual meeting, we have to have a policy in place. So that's why we're working on writing the policy. We sent it to the prosecutor's office. Jenny Nichols was looking at it. She had a lot of questions about that, like why did we not include hybrid option in the policy? So we're in the process of that, you know, answering those questions and revising that. So that's why it's not ready for review by the board right now. And I think it's going to require a second meeting of the bylaw and policy committee meeting to review the final, revised final draft before we bring it back and forth to the board. So hopefully we can get that back in front of you guys in July. Yes, sir.
Just as a comment. Nothing
yes.
more.
Sure.
I was in a meeting that was a hybrid the other day, and there was a glitch with the technical equipment and everything. We had to cancel the meeting because of that. So just for consideration.
Which is definitely considered and why I don't want to do hybrid. It's just too much work. It's too expensive. My preference is always going to be in person, unless we have to cancel a meeting because we're not going to be able to meet quorum for any other way by doing virtual. You know, I hate to cancel meetings because of quorum not being met and rescheduled. So there's a lot of work that goes into setting up for this meeting, and I want to be thoughtful of that.
But the comment, my comment wasn't supposed to limit it only to hybrid.
No. I understand what you're saying.
If we do virtual and there's an issue with a piece of equipment with just one person.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I've got a problem.
That's why it's only if it would not be the norm. It would be only in those extreme circumstances, in my opinion. I think that just.
If
it's
for whatever
in the best
reason
interest.
We got a shutdown again, we would have to have a policy
leverage that particular. Although, frankly, if we had another pandemic, they'd probably just do another thing that said, yeah, you can meet whether you've got a policy or not. But, yeah, so that would be the last resort to meet all virtually because that's a lot of work and a lot of effort. So, and we don't. I have an easy way to accommodate public participation that way. There's, you know, we have to have people muted, yet they have to be able to speak when they can speak, but then not be able to speak otherwise and have a way to contact us in case they have any technical issues and can't get into the meeting. There's just a lot. So,
what you do about nothing?
Well, so we're working on that, and hopefully we'll be able to meet again and get it all ironed out and bring it forth to you. For July.
It is complicated.
It is. It's It is complicated. Any questions about the hybrid virtual meeting policy that is ongoing? Mr. Humphrey, did I forget anything or anything you want to add? Okay. All right. Yeah. Moving on. Yes.
In the minutes,
yes.
Could we have each one of these policies identified by name, that since we have
sure.
a motion and whatever, because even on the agenda that I got, talked about J1 or JI, and I'm going, I don't know what JI is, but I'm guessing based on things that I was reading that the missing thing wasn't the, was the hybrid.
6B, 6C, 6D, yes,
whatever.
Exactly. Yep, yep, yep. So I think that makes perfect sense.
I don't care. I just whatever the title of the policy is, and then all of them effective as of today. You know,
I mean, we could do just like motion was made, you know,
just
for the following, and then have them bulleted out.
Adopted a number of policies. What are those? You know.
Yeah, we could just bullet them out after the motion.
That's good.
Statement. Yep. Thank you for that clarification. All right, moving on in the agenda, I just want to recognize the board is in receipt of correspondence received from resident Christopher Myers. And we appreciate the suggestions that were included in the correspondence, but we will not be making any changes at this time. So, next item that Chris already talked to a little bit is old business for the cell phone stipend. So can we go over that again?
Sure. Sorry about
that. That's okay. You were just excited about it.
Concentrating so much on the budget piece. Mm-hmm. All right. So back to my director's report. It's $45 a month per phone per person. Includes a phone, includes the data, etc. So proposing that the stipend be reduced to $21.77 per pay period. It's basically $45 divided by times 12 divided by the 26 pay periods is how that comes out. So you get a 45 times 12 is per month, the total for a whole year, divided by the fact that there's 26 pay periods in a year.
How did you come up with the $21.77?
45 times 12.
But how did you come up with a 40? Like, I'm sorry, I'm not tracking on the map.
45 was the estimate from a vendor to provide himself.
Okay, got
yes,
it. Sorry that you didn't
leave
it right. Okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Current vendor for the funds that we provide for staff.
And I'm sorry, did you say, I knew you said $45 per person per pay period. So it's 26
per month. $45 per month.
$45 per month.
Per month. So multiply that by 12 and divide it by 26 pay period comes down to $21.77 a pay period.
Okay.
So we're recommending reducing the stipend to $21.77 or giving a staff member the option to just have a library phone provided.
With all the services and whatever. And no stipend.
Right? Correct.
So,
because if we're providing the phone, why would we provide the stipend?
Exactly.
Right.
There'd be no
right.
need to provide the stipend.
So with this phone, so with this $45 per month, if someone wants to go under that option, at what point is that phone considered paid off? Is that phone purchased outright? Is that phone renewed every 2 years under that? I mean, how does that agreement work with
the phones
provider?
Are provided for free as part of Lynn's negotiation with our T-Mobile rep. And how many? Yes.
Verizon.
Sorry. We already have a certain number of phones that we provide for facility staff. They're in the library vehicles. The IS department all carries them. For if you're out in the field and you need to be gotten a hold of, they used to have beepers way back in the day, graduated to phones. So we already have an account with Verizon, and so working with that rep, it's $45 a month for the service, and the phones are free. Because
part of
the
problem with a free phone every 2 years, when do we get a free
phone? 3 years?
3 years.
Part of the problem that particularly the fiscal office would have is if we switched everyone over to a library provided phone. All of our, like when we log in to pay the taxes for the RITA, pay taxes for Kentucky, pay taxes for Ohio, do the workman's comp, check that, the auditor, everything we log into has that third party authentication, and it is tied to our, we've been getting it on our cell phones because we both get the stipend. It would be extremely difficult for us to change all of that over and get it in a timely manner. So that's why I'm recommending that we also have the option to keep your own phone and get the stipend.
But if you get that TPA, you would just have it come to that phone. Well, you're saying you'd have to change the phone number?
You'd have to change everything, right. All of our identification that we already have with that.
I understand.
Okay.
And we're not talking about taking away the stipend, so that, that we're just making it right with the current cost of funds and service.
Mm-hmm. As currently negotiated.
Yep. And we'll come back to
it. Because it was like in the, it was in the 900 amounts or whatever when we went over the amounts last time and I figured out what that cost was.
Right. It was pretty spendy. Yeah.
Very spendy. And that's why, and the other aspect of the only thing and I understand that changing anything, it's like calling Opers. The aspect of it is that, what about the privacy issues on everything when somebody says, well, we want all of your emails. Right. Well, you're paying a stipend for that phone. And I don't know whether that's the full cost of the phone, but what way are you going to be able to, what way are you going to be able to separate business calls in and as it relates to library business from your personal calls that are on that phone?
Since the only thing that is a public record is records, conversations on a phone are not records.
But texts are.
But if they text
and
or
emails
they email
are.
Or they.
We have
or they
but emails are emails, that's a different thing.
You can pull those
text
up.
Texts are the thing that
text
would
the other.
Apply to a phone.
And here's the thing. Here's where I'm going to try not to say too much on this because from a compliance perspective, you don't cross the streams. You don't ever have, a personal phone that you're using for work. You have a separate work phone and your separate personal phone in my world. So that's why I have that personal bias that I bring to this that makes me a little like, I would not do that. So.
No, you didn't get a stipend, but did you?
I used my own phone. I never had a county phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
The others did, I know.
Well, but the issue that you're raising, Judy, is something that we saw in the prosecutor's office where when you get into litigation, they don't just say, give me all your emails with that you had related to the library. They say, give me your laptop, give me your iPad,
mm-hmm.
give me
yeah.
your phone. And they sort through. So the issue is more now your private activities are going to be reviewed by whomever in a litigation environment, I think.
That's
and you're without a phone. So
yep,
you're
exactly.
even more in, like if you're worried about having to switch something over and that being time consuming, and just think about the option of if there was something that required litigation and discovery, you may have to turn that personal phone over completely,
and
then
there
you
may
have
be
nothing.
There may be another way to get a library phone and have the telephone number moved there and therefore just take a new personal number if there are too many things that are tied to the phone that are library related.
Mm-hmm. I just want you guys to think about this a little bit. I know personally I'm very anti-personal for work use, and it sounds like we do have some library phones that are already, we're already doing that model, right? But just not in the same way. we were talking about for those eight associates, and that need to be 24/7.
It's the 24/7.
Right, it's the 24/7. It's the, yeah.
Available. That's, yep. That's the reason.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, for the purpose of the audit, where we have to memorialize the actual stipend, it sounds like we need to have a motion to approve the $21.77 per person per pay period stipend.
And can that start with pay period 14? Because
starting with pay period 14.
So moved.
All right, Mr. Humphrey makes the motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Mr. Ramos seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, motion passes.
What was that amount per person?
21.77 per person per pay period for the eight administrative staff. Maybe I shouldn't say administrative staff. Is that right? That's right.
And today starts the pay period 14, so it would be as of today.
As of today, which is the start of pay period 14. For clarity. Okay. All good? I'm curious to see what you guys decide. Okay, I will have one item to add after the new business that is kind of new business, so just let's keep going through the agenda here. Next up is Resolution 2025-16, the acceptance of gifts to the library, donations as listed. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
All right, Ms. White makes a motion. Do I have a second?
So moved.
Mr. Ramos seconds.
I'm second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Next item is Resolution 2025-17, disposal of unneeded or obsolete library inventory. Do I have a motion?
Wasn't so big this time, Jenny.
Okay, yeah, still. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
All right, Ms. Waits makes a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Anybody? Okay, Mr. Ramos seconds. May I have a roll call vote, please?
Ms. Doss?
Yes.
Mr. Ramos?
Yes.
Ms. Wade?
Yes.
Ms. Gosica?
Yes.
Mr. Humphrey?
Yes.
Ms. Bach? Ms. Schluter?
Thank you. All right. One kind of add-on, walk-on item from Mr. Ramos about the Batavia Branch and the Building Committee. Go ahead.
Right. I know, you know, with the money issues and the budget and everything that's going on, we're not in a position to make any immediate decisions about a new public library in Batavia. But I would like the building committee to meet to at least start looking at and considering and exploring that possibility.
So you're calling for another meeting of the building committee to review the current options and how things may have changed since the last discussion. Does that sound fair?
Yes.
Okay. We don't need a formal motion for that, so. Ms. Wade's here. Yes, Mr. Humphrey.
Well, I agree.
No, I'm just raising for another issue.
Oh, okay. Any other questions, comments on Batavia and Building Committee? So you guys will get together and then let us know what you find out when you come back next time. Okay. Mr. Humphrey?
I had a brainstorm. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
I was wondering if we could change this room around and put the head table up here and the podium over there so it's near the technology side, and the person then could point to the chart and be able to better make their presentation, and y'all wouldn't have to move
every single time.
I think the presentation. So I wanted to bring that up to the board to see if they feel good about it or bad about it or whatever.
What do you guys think about it, Chris?
I think we talked about that, Lynn, from a technical perspective. I'm sorry, Chris. As far as the outlets and stuff, it creates a little bit of difficulty.
My understanding was it was okay. We have plugs over there and plugs over there, so.
It creates issues with the space for audience.
Yes, the audience.
Yeah.
For public participation.
We have such a large audience that I'm not real concerned about it, but if we turn the tables around, I would consider letting them sit in this area and turn around to see the slides if they wanted to see them and face the group or be in the center, like these chairs are currently.
I mean, I'm willing to, if you play with it, if you see that it's not going to be doable, then...
We did.
Okay, so you did play with it.
Yes.
Okay.
And
when we were testing hybrid meeting options, we tested. Yes.
Okay.
It created some technical issues and some layout issues, trip hazards and things like that.
I'm hearing trip hazards and technical issues with the revised layout when they were testing it for the hybrid meeting.
We did.
We'll talk again. We're not doing a hybrid meeting, so that isn't an issue. But I'll be glad to talk to you about it, and then we'll bring it back up to the next one.
Okay.
Or you could just take those three tables
and add them on.
Three tables over there, and there's the screen, and it's very elementary.
That was my thought, is move those tables over here and be done. That's all.
Yeah. So the meeting would take place basically where Jennifer is. There's one set of power there.
The meeting would take place between that. Consider that closed. And the head table would be near that, like it is this wall.
We can take a look at that.
I'm fine with whatever works for you guys.
So the seats would be faced that way, and then so the public would have to turn around if there was a presentation.
Yeah.
Got it.
But it would seem like
enter in the middle here. They'd have
to allow them to talk to the screen and point to things if they want to. The podium would be there. It just seems like it would work much better to me. So, just one guy.
We could maybe try it.
Hey, if it doesn't work, we'll just move the tables that day.
As long as I get something with glitter, that's all I care. I don't care where I'm sitting. All right. Any other comments, questions, any other new walk-on items? And thank you for that suggestion, Mr. Humphrey. In the interest of efficiency, I get it. Nope, nothing? Okay, housekeeping item, just a reminder, our next meeting is July 21st. Can't believe we're already halfway through this year. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Mr. Humphrey makes the motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
All right, Ms. Wade seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Any opposed? Motion passes. So we are adjourning at 7:47 p.m.